Hello and welcome to We Recover Loudly, the podcast shaking up conversations about addiction, recovery and drinking cultures in hospitality. This podcast aims to break down the walls of silence around addiction and recovery within the industry. The episodes will be a mix of personal stories from myself and from other sober champions with experience of working in hospitality, as well as interviews with hospitality leaders who have provided training and resources to assist in creating sustainable workplace environments for you and your teams. We will discuss mental health, stress, and other challenges in the industry that can lead to addiction, challenging the work hard, play hard mentality. My name is Shell. I am not a mental health professional or sober coach. I am, however, someone with lived experience of addiction and recovery who chooses to share her story to help others. Because when we recover loudly, we stop others dying quietly. So let's get loud. Before we get started with today's episode, I want to give a shout out to our sponsor, The Burnt Chef Project. The Burnt Chef Project is a globally recognised not-for-profit social enterprise. They're fully committed to making the hospitality profession healthier, more sustainable, by focusing on people's well-being first. Launched in May 2019, the Burnt Chef Project was set up with the sole intention of eradicating mental health stigma within hospitality. They offer free resources online, such as wellness action plans and team check-in guidelines. You can also book mental health first aid courses through the website, as well as other bespoke training courses for your hospitality team. I've been an ambassador with the organisation for over 18 months and I'm proud to be a part of such an inspiring and forward-thinking community. For more information, check out their website and their socials. Links are all there in the show notes. Right, on with the episode. Hello and welcome to this week's episode of We Recover Loudly. Today I am joined by Colette Saffill. Now, while her name might not be immediately familiar, her non-alcoholic drink brand certainly will be. Colette is the creator of the non-alcoholic rum alternative Myth Drinks. Currently in two flavors, we've got a rich and heady dark spiced rum, and she's also created the world's first coconut white rum alternative. She's been sober herself for the last 23 years and after working as a therapist for the last 15 years, decided that the non-alcoholic drinking category was missing that fun element and so started this business alongside everything else she does, which is just incredible. Colette, thank you so much for joining me today.
Oh, thank you so much for inviting me. I quite like that intro, actually. It doesn't always feel as dynamic like that when you're living it, you know?
It's funny, isn't it? It's when you condense everything that you do and you hear it back, you think, gosh, I actually do quite a lot.
I'm tired.
Exactly. Well, let's dive straight into talking about Myth Drinks. I tried both of your rum alternatives last week at an event hosted by the Alcohol Free Drink Company. And I'm not just saying this, I was genuinely blown away. If I didn't like them, I would be doing the awkward, yeah, they're awesome. But no, I was genuinely blown away because they were just so rich. And the thing that I really liked was that heavy mouthfeel, because I definitely find with some non-alcoholic spirits more so, it misses that, doesn't it? The way that it doesn't coat your mouth. And I have to be honest with the coconut one, I did actually have to check the bottle, because it tasted so much like a certain other coconut rum that we shall not name.
It's interesting. A few people say that. Yeah, I've had some people report that they've had it at hen parties and things and woken up the next morning and all commented how they feel fine because they hadn't realised it was alcohol free. So, yeah, so it's quite interesting. But the mouthfeel was one of the things I really wanted to create, because I wanted, just for me, when I mixed the spirits that were available on the market, I found that they were a bit thin and all I could taste was mixer, really. So I wanted my drinks to be able to be drunk really simply. The white one can be drunk neat, fair, they both can, or in a really simple serve, or in a like fabulous long, fancy, poncy cocktail that you've spent ages getting all the ingredients for that nobody's ever heard of. And, you know, complete with umbrella on the top. But I wanted to be able to do all those things, but for there still to be a place within that for the spirit. Otherwise, it felt a bit pointless to add it.
Yeah, I mean, I was a dark spirit drinker primarily. And like you say, it's that viscosity and it's that heat
that you immediately lose when the alcohol is taken away, because, you know, that's the burn, you know, and the sugar and all of that kind of goes. And it really is nice to be able to feel like you're enjoying something of the same level just without the alcohol, like you say, rather than having to sit at the kids' table with an elderflower with a sprig of mint in it.
It is exactly that. And there's something about, I don't know how many people have seen the bottles, but the artist who did my artwork for me is an artist. There's something about it being of the same level, maybe even higher than some of the alcohol drinks. I know when I was drinking alcoholically, I certainly wasn't choosing the best available and I wasn't treated the best available. And when I got sober, I found that I still wasn't given the best available and I wasn't treated the best available. I vividly remember being given a can of Fanta in the can at a tasting lunch where everyone else had really expensive wines and things. And I just wanted to create something that was beautiful and that had clearly been crafted, but also served the purpose it was there for. So interestingly, the dark one, everybody likes the coconut, the dark's more divisive, but I made it to go into coffee. Because I really wanted that kind of calypso coffee, you know, an end of meal coffee liqueur type space. And it does really well for the coffee and the cream and the sugar. Makes a great kind of Brandy Alexander, a really good nitro espresso mix as well. But because of that, it had to be a strong flavor in order to carry through.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds absolute. Having tasted it, yeah, I would love that in an espresso martini. That would be really, really good. It's interesting what you were saying about when you were drinking. I mean, yeah, the last thing I used to look at was the label. I remember you get the, by the end of my drinking career, as we call it, for some reason, I didn't feel like a career. I certainly didn't get paid. Like, I would get the cheapest of the cheap off the shelf and it would have like a white label. It looked like a child had like scrawled gin or something on it. Yeah. And it's so wonderful to have such an array of beautiful non-alcoholic, that labeling, because you're right, it really does make you feel, not that you're missing out, but that you're, it doesn't even make you feel that you're like included, like, oh, here you go, here's something that's a bit like it. It makes it feel like it's yours. It's unique.
Yeah. And that's what I was just about to say that to you. So I not had a drink for a long time, nearly 23 years. And when I did drink, I didn't drink pretty. So cocktails were never my thing. And I spend a lot of time now with bar owners and mixologists and people like that. But I am genuinely interested in what people do with these drinks, how they make. And please, if you do make something amazing or you do think, do you know what? That's just awesome. Send me what you've made. You'll find me through the website, through Insta. I actually want to know, because my biggest challenge was having not been in those environments for all these years. I didn't really know what I was trying to create. I think in some ways that's why I created a cool thing, because I didn't have any parameters, but then to try and fashion that. So someone said to me, I think it was last week, I was at an event and this lady came and told me that there's a really big thing at the minute for Guinness mixed with Malibu. Now, I didn't know that, because why would I know that? And I know, but apparently it's really
that
good.
That sounds absolutely
well, if you look, there's a big movement for Guinness mixed with all sorts of liqueurs and spirits. But obviously there's a zero Guinness now, and I make a zero.
That is.
I make a zero Malibu. So it will probably We can make this happen. Now, that isn't something I would ever consider, and I'm not sure I'll be trying it on myself. I can feel my poor husband being a guinea pig again. But it's things like that. And some things are just really good and you don't expect them to be. And some things are really not, actually. My favourite surf for the white one is my young daughter has one of those ice crush machine things. It sounds like a bomb going off in the kitchen, you know. And if you put some ice through that, crush it up, just put some neat white myth on top of it, a straw in it and a little squeeze of lime and leave the lime wedge in. That's, in my opinion, the best way to have it. Simple as.
That sounds heavenly. And actually, I was just thinking when we were joking about, oh, it's a trend to do that. Like, it blows my mind that you're right. We can literally follow that trend with the two non-alcoholic alternatives. That's incredible.
Yeah.
You know, that's a move towards that inclusivity.
I'm not sitting here as the head of the brand saying, I made this, I know everything about it. I'm saying, I did create this, go me, fantastic, but I know nothing about it. I know nothing about the industry. I know nothing. Well, I know a lot now, but when I started, I knew nothing. I know nothing about the mixes. I don't know better than you what you're going to do with it. So please share it. Please let me know, you know, let the community know how this serve can work. I sell a lot of the dark one to chefs in the Middle East, and they make things like tiramisu and things like that with it, where the alcohol won't be flamed off. So, or rum and raisin ice cream is another one. And again, I would never have thought of that, but that's what they do. So I find it really interesting how when you don't have to follow a framework, you don't have to follow someone else's blueprint, and you can just kind of go to the ends of your own creativity, what that can look like.
Yeah, because it really, it's flavor, and it sounds ridiculous. I almost only had this like light bulb moment the other day where when I started drinking, for me, when I started drinking, I was drinking for flavor. I was a sommelier for years. I worked as a cocktail bartender, developing menus, things like that. And for me, alcohol at that time, it wasn't about what it was doing to my body. It was about layering flavors, complexities, contrasting, creating moments like a chef would on a plate, but within a glass. And slowly, as alcohol for me became something that I needed to cope with life, I forgot about flavor. Flavor was the last thing. Mm-hmm. I didn't give a shit what it tasted like because it was completely inconsequential. And last week when I was at this drinks tasting and I had some of yours and I tried a couple of others, and it was almost a little bit moving to think that I've almost got drinks back. You know, I've got that love back because I love that flavor and I love creating. And because of the work like yourself and all these other incredible producers are doing, I get to go back to why I loved it in the first place, you know?
I hear people say that, particularly with the Malibu type one, the white one. I've had women burst into tears when they've drunk it. There's something quite evocative about it. I had one lady said, "Oh, you've taken me right back to my first kiss at 16 on a beach in Greece," and things like that. And I wonder if it's because, and this is going to be really obvious once I've said it, but you're probably going to go, "Oh yeah, I haven't thought about that." I wonder if because I obviously haven't tasted Malibu for a quarter of a century. So I just kind of made a memory. I wasn't sitting in a lab drinking Malibu and then testing to see if my product tasted the same. I made what I remembered. And I think in some ways it's almost made it more than the drink itself was at the time, because obviously the memory does that. It kind of magnifies.
Yeah. So like the secret ingredient is nostalgia. And that's kind of, like you say, that triggers those memories. And it's funny because, I mean, I can't drink an energy drink without having terrible memories of vodka Red Bulls and student unions. So I'm just like, I don't know why anyone would drink that for any other reason. But like you say, it's nice to be able to be brought back to those positive moments, because I think it's very easy to sit and demonize alcohol and, you know, throw blame at it, at the industry, how dare, all of these kind of things. But, you know, it's for some people, it works. And for some people, it's a positive part of their life. And that's also fine. But to be able to kind of almost, I don't know, almost feel like I can make peace with the part of it that was causing me harm and enjoy the part of it that wasn't, is just a really cool time. It's a great time to be sober.
It is actually. So I know people say to me, you know, "Oh, you don't drink." And that isn't true. I do. I just don't put alcohol in the glass. I put lots of other things in the glass, but I don't not drink. And it is a cool time to be sober. So when I got sober sort of nearly 23 years ago, it was not a cool time to be getting sober. You know, there were very few places to go, and it certainly wasn't a visible thing. Still a lot of shame, a lot of guilt, a lot of punitive outcomes, because most people, for myself, I came to sobriety through a consequence, and the consequences of some really poor behaviours. So having to recover from that as well, you know, that kind of societal shame and everything that goes with that, and rebuild my life at the same time as kind of finding recovery almost in secret. It certainly wasn't spoken about the way it is now. It was a very difficult thing. And actually, when I launched the drinks, my single biggest issue was that somebody was going to ask me about my drinking, and I wasn't sure if I wanted to say. I wasn't sure if I wanted to say I was alcoholic, even though I'm fellowship, so I say it at least three times a week in a village hall somewhere. But that's still a very closed group. It's still a very protected group. And I didn't know if I wanted to feel exposed again, as I had done at the end of my drinking. And I took it really slowly. And then one day I was at something or other with the drinks and somebody said, oh, so why did you do this? And it just sort of fell out of my face because I say it so often in other arenas. As soon as I said, I thought, well, that is just my truth. You know, I made this because there was nothing safe for me to drink. It's not just about choice for me, it's about safety. I believe if I had another drink, I would probably die because I nearly died last time. And I didn't want to be excluded anymore from the whole of the rest of the experience. You know, the pretty dress and your good lipstick in a nice venue with nice dinner and your friends and all of those things. It's more than the alcohol in the glass if we really want it down. It's the ritual and the relevance and the environment and the time and all of those other things. And I just felt excluded from it.
Yeah, I mean, nobody gets dressed up to drink a can of Fanta. I mean, that's ridiculous.
It's the thing I've ever heard someone say. No one gets dressed up for a can of Fanta.
Apologies, Fanta, but it's just not a thing. I mean, 23 years ago, what was the alternative, I guess? I mean, like you say, it is a very different time now. There is a lot still to be done. There is a lot of shame, especially in the hospitality industry, coming out saying that you're sober, hence We Recover Loudly. But I mean, 23 years ago, what was it like in terms of options?
I was sectioned into an NHS psychiatric unit and I was sectioned for my own safety because I was very unwell by that point. I was 28. So I was very young and I didn't really start drinking till I was 21, 22. I just overachieved really quickly, really got the hang of it, really overachieved. I was really fortunate in that I was able to, after a week, I was able to be moved to a priory where I was in the ATP, which is addiction treatment unit. And I stayed there for months, months and months and months. I did never have another drink ever. I've been really fortunate. I've kept that. But part of Priory, they used to bus us out every night to local fellowship groups. And that was the only place to go. And sometimes I think in a way it helped because there weren't lots of options. So you either committed or you didn't. And I think sometimes if you haven't got an option, then you make the best of what you've got. So it could have been that. And, you know, all fellowships are different and all meetings are different, actually, because they're autonomous. And it took me a while to find my space, but I did. And I stuck close to it. And I still live every day now, just not causing myself a problem for the next day. That's kind of how I live my life. There was nowhere to be proud of it. So until I made the drinks and until somebody was asking me and then said, oh, my God, that's amazing, that there's nowhere to be proud of the fact that I stopped drinking, that I've maintained sobriety for all these years and I did what needed to be done. And it wasn't always easy because the unsaid is, well, it was a shameful thing to have been doing. So you can't really say that, you know. So that's actually been quite liberating in some ways. And despite being really close to fellowship and having had really good treatment, I can honestly say it wasn't until I made the drinks and started speaking to people more openly, kind of in the wider community about my drinking and why I don't drink anymore. I felt a kind of a liberation that it was okay. It was okay. I wasn't aligned with it. It wasn't a secret. It didn't have to just belong to a very small group of people. And it was something to not exactly be proud of, but to not be ashamed of, I think is probably how I feel.
Thank you so much for sharing that. You 100% should not feel ashamed. And yet I completely and totally relate to everything you've just said. And I think that people don't see people like you, people like me, saying we're sober. It's not a lifestyle choice. We actually had a really bad problem. It was something that became life-threatening. But do you know what? We put some work in, we got a load of support, and life is now different. And that's kind of universal, regardless of where you work or what you do. You know, I sometimes feel like there's an arrogance within the hospitality industry that alcoholism is something that won't get them, because our industry is so open in terms of its consumption and its competitiveness with consumption and its relentlessness as well. You know, it's just, it's day in, day out, drinking after shift, drinking during shift. It's just constant. And for me, my story is that it was a very slow burner. And then before I knew it, there was just nothing in my skill sets that I could use to deal with life apart from alcohol. And I sometimes think it's quite important that people realize, you know, you don't get to 30 and get a letter in the post that says, congratulations, you're not an alcoholic. Go as you are. You know, it can happen at any time. And I think the fact that you came in so young is really inspiring and really, really interesting. There's so many more young people doing that. I mean, did you ever have a feeling of like, I'm too young for this? Do you know what? I'm going to carry on for another 5-10 years. I mean, I certainly did when I came in and I was not 28. You know what I mean?
No. So my mother died alcoholic when I was a child. She died by suicide. And I can still to this day remember the bottle of the green bottle of Gordon's gin next to her when they found her. And I was 10. But my whole family, or her side of the family, all have a problem with alcohol. So that's why I didn't really drink as much when I was very young, like in my teens and things. I sort of stayed away from it intuitively. But when I did pick it up, it was so fast. It was so fast. And I was involved in an RTA, a drink drive RTA. And the tiny bit of structure I had in my life completely fell away at that point. And for 3 or 4 weeks, I was just sick in the bucket. Didn't know if it was day or night. And really in quite a lot of danger. And then I just stopped. I just one Thursday morning thought, this is ridiculous. I'm going to have to stop. And I went into the DTs. So I had, you know, horrific hallucinations. And as I say, I nearly died. And I just could never do that again. I know I couldn't. I don't know how I recovered that time. So I wouldn't have it in me to do that again. And it took nearly a year and a half for me to get well. I've still got about 6 months amnesia now. From just before that happened, I had all sorts of quite, I won't go into detail, and I've got all sorts of quite unusual therapies, including electric shock treatment, all sorts of things. And it did take quite a long time to kind of fix my head. And actually, my thought processes since have been quite different. So people who know me well would kind of say I'm almost autistic. I kind of go from A to B with no side roads and come across as very blunt because of it. And I never used to be like that before, ever. It's like the cotton wool got taken away was as part of my recovery. But I just couldn't do that again. I couldn't do that again. I remember having like spiders crawling out of my mouth and I could feel their legs and I can remember it even now. And I took it really seriously. I saw it kill my mother. I knew what it was and I knew what I needed to do to get well. And at the time, the fellowship was the place to do that. And I knew the fellowship because of my mother anyway. So I kind of felt safe there. So for me, despite being very young, then no, I never thought I've got another 5 years. I don't think I had another 5 days, if I'm really honest. I was very, very thin and very broken as well.
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. Yeah, and I'm not surprised. And I do, you know what, it really brings home. I don't think that we always realize that this is a life and death illness. You know, it really is. And people's lives are at stake. And one of the which I know sounds a bit dramatic, but it's so true. It's just true. And as hospitality workers, as employers, managers, and I know you haven't yourself worked in the industry, but you're around a lot more of those types of people. You know, I do feel that we have a responsibility to create an environment and a culture that promotes healthy, balanced attitudes towards something which has the potential to kill. And does. And I think personally, in my experience, that is severely lacking. I mean, as an industry, we have a problem. However, as a country, you know, we have a problem. Why do you think we have such a problem with alcohol in this country?
Ooh, that's a big question. Obviously, I work in the field of psychotherapy, so I see this a lot. I think that people are very lonely and there's nothing to kind of connect to. So we used to have church, or we used to have working men's clubs, or we used to have women's groups, or we used to have extended family, or we used to have something to belong to, or some kind of societal parameters. I think, you know, when people stopped drinking in pubs and started drinking at home, for example, you know, those types of things. I think it's partly that. I think it's partly cultural. I'm a little bit of a conspiracy theorist, so I'd always want to know who stands to gain if it's not the person using it. I know in the town I live in a small town in North Yorkshire, a small market town, and we've just had opened a new fast food outlet, having not had one before, 24 hours. That's going to help the obesity epidemic. And a 24-hour kind of shop attached to a garage, attached to a petrol station, that is a 24-hour off license. If that had been available when I was drinking, I would be dead. There's no question. No question at all. So there's a huge piece of research done about maybe 10 years ago, and it looked at drivers for increased use of alcohol. And one of them is simply availability. If you can get it, you're more likely to drink it. And I think we just need to be questioning that. I've got a bit of a problem with those fun pubs, you know, the ones with the ball pits that are full of children and snot, those ones. You know, why would we take our children from such a young age to that as the environment where you get leisure without some other balance, without something else as well, for example? And I know with alcohol-free drinks and kind of corporate social responsibility, I agree that all industries have a responsibility to ensure that there is a choice for everyone, no matter what they're doing. You know, the same as there's a vegan choice and everything else.
Gluten-free.
One of my daughters is celiac, actually, so I know a lot about it. There's always those choices, and there should be the same, and it should be an equal and fair choice, not here's a rubbish AF lager, give that a go. Oh, you don't like lager, best have Fanta then. Your choice. And I wonder if more people would take that choice if it was better. And that's partly what I came to the industry for, because I wanted to make something I would be prepared to drink.
Yeah, I think that there's something about availability that almost makes it feel that there's somebody behind you saying that it's okay to do. Therefore, if it's available, that means it's okay. If Deliveroo will bring me 3 bottles of wine and the guy won't question the fact that, you know, anything about my consumption, that means it's okay. And you're right. I mean, what point do we need alcohol 24 hours a day? Who needs alcohol 24 hours a day? The people that need alcohol are the people that are actually the ones that need help, rather. And there just doesn't feel like there is a need or a place for it at all. I mean, and when you were saying, yeah, about what they're drinking at these fun pubs and stuff. And for me, one of the things I find the most ridiculous is I get the train a lot. I live in Bath. I go to London a lot for work. And every time I get on the train, regardless of the time of day, whether it's morning, noon or night, there is somebody sitting next to me drinking a gin in a tin.
Yeah.
When did that happen?
When did it become that easy? When I've got a problem with those hard seltzers, the ones that look like fruit juice, and they doesn't even clearly say the ABV on it. It's got the calories bigger than the alcohol volume. You know, when did that happen? When it's almost like it's being forced, I think. But when did that happen? In the face of all the research about cancer links and societal breakdown and all of those things, I think, well, who stands to gain from this? I don't drink, that's my choice. And what other people do is entirely up to them. But I am impacted by it sometimes. I was on a train recently. There was a guy kicking off. I had one of my young daughters with me. She was terrified. He was bladdered at like 3 in the afternoon. When did that become okay? You know, that's impacting me. It's impacting my daughter. I haven't agreed to that. I haven't invited that in. You know, when did that become okay? I do very much question the direction of society.
Yeah. And again, it's that whole, I myself would sit on a train years previous, I think, when this whole kind of transportable gin in a tin and obviously other beverages as well became initially a thing. And again, it was like, well, I just bought this in Marks and Spencer's and I'm sat on a train and the other people are doing it. And you almost say to yourself, is this okay? Well, yes, it is okay. And
it's sponsored.
It's just so entrenched in our culture in every facet. I mean, as somebody who is questioning whether or not they want to kind of slope, maybe cut down a little bit, I think it's quite scary because, like you said earlier, you feel that you're going to be excluded.
Yeah. I always see, you know, I was listening to the radio, I won't say who it was, the other day, and she was like, oh, come on, mummies, it's 5 o'clock. No, well done. You've got to the Prosecco time. Well done for surviving the week. And then I was in one of the big supermarkets and I saw this glass that was etched on the front and it actually said mummies Prosecco. And it was like, you know, it was like a bucket, this thing. And how can this not be seen as condoning, encouraging, and just normalizing something that is not normal? It's not normal if you've got small children to not be able to care for them. That's not normal. And if you've been drinking, you probably can't. So it's all of those things. And I do struggle with it, but like, I'm always really acutely aware that my experience is extreme. But then I see lots of people, you know, of a Friday, Saturday night in the cities, we send police, armed police in order to police the streets because of the alcohol use. And that's normal.
Yeah. And I also think that while your story ended in a really extreme and incredibly tragic and all of that incredibly dark place, that's where it ends for people, if they're lucky.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things I hope that I kind of can convey, is that while at the moment you might be sitting there and you're desperate to get home after work because you can't wait to have a bottle of wine, but you're only having a bottle of wine, so that's fine. Like, that's nothing like what Colette's just been describing. That bottle of wine for me over the months became two. And then over the months, suddenly it's three. And that's the insidious scariness about alcohol, because if you're not questioning the reason behind your consumption and the behaviors, I think for me, that's where anybody, come whatever social class, educational background, age, gender, anyone is starting to play a dangerous game.
Yeah, I think the Chinese have a saying, don't they? A man takes a drink takes a drink, and the drink takes the man. And I think sometimes people drink because they drink. There isn't really another reason. You know, why are you drinking? Because I had a drink. You know, and like you say, we're using alcohol to stay in situations which are not good for us. So to stop it hurting, you know, relationships, work, societal issues, that we're just staying in that, and drinks making it possible to stay. So we don't feel the flames, we don't feel the burn. So we've got all that opportunity loss as well of people who could be making real changes and staying in quite harmful situations because they just don't have to feel it. And that's what I see a lot in my work.
Yeah, and every time I celebrate a sobriety birthday or a friend celebrates a sobriety birthday, I always think in my head, like, what are we really celebrating? And it's like, well, you know, you're celebrating living your life with a clear head. You're celebrating honesty. You're celebrating, in a weird way, you're celebrating feeling emotions, being able to sit with things. And, you know, you kind of cheer each other on and say congratulations on 30 days, but it's not the fact that you haven't drunk for 30 days that the only reason you're being celebrated. It's the fact you've lived for 30 days in that pain, in that mess, in that disorder, and you've grown through it. You know, that's the real celebration.
I think so. I mean, I was in a meeting last night and someone did their 30 days, and there's something about seeing that reminds you where you were. But I would say the further away you get from a drink, the harder it can be sometimes to remember why you don't. Because I know if someone met me now, that they would never be able to equate me with the person I was back then. And it's important to remember that that's where it takes me. A lot of people say to me who aren't in fellowship, say to me, oh, surely it's been that long, you can just have one. I think, why would I? Why would anybody take that risk? But I understand the question. But I know for me, that's not an option anymore. So I'm just watching my dogs. They're having a bit of a scrap in the corner.
God, love them. What can people do to connect that doesn't involve alcohol in your experience? Like, what kind of things do you enjoy doing for fun? Because again, if someone's listening to this thinking, well, I'm going to give up alcohol and therefore I'm giving up on life, you know, it's so entrenched in culture. What do you do?
Exactly the opposite. You don't give up on alcohol and give up on life. That is the opposite. You say goodbye alcohol, and then you pick up a life that you haven't been living. And I guess some of it is about going back to maybe what you enjoyed when you were younger, things that you've maybe put down, because alcohol tends to take all the space. So you no longer play that tennis game or play the piano or I don't know, play netball or whatever it was, you know, because you just sit and drink now, and maybe travel. Maybe I like to do at least one thing every year that's new and challenging. So a couple of years ago, I learned to play the piano. I play about as well as a two-year-old. I know this because I YouTubed a piece of music that I was trying to learn, and the child playing on YouTube was so small, she had to be lifted onto the piano stool by her parent. But I know, not motivating. And that was a couple of years ago. This year, I've gone back to uni to do a research qualification in social constructivism, because I like to do things like that. I think sometimes just keeping your brain working, you know, just trying something that is new, is difficult, is inspiring. I wrote a book last year. There are all these things. People often say, how do you get time to do all the things you do? It's because I don't drink. And because I don't drink, I don't tend to do the other things that go with it. So I don't tend to make poor food choices or make poor life choices or lose whole weekends with a hangover or things like that. You know, so I think start with your body, soul and mind. You know, what will feed those three things? What do they need? What have you been neglecting? And where do you find joy? Where do you honestly find joy? Because I would argue that you're not finding it where you're currently looking for it, because if you were, you wouldn't be needing a drink to get through it.
Yeah, definitely. And you will never find joy in a bottle, in a can. No. It doesn't live there.
Interestingly, I'm about to launch in a couple of weeks some new RTDs. So some pre-made cocktails in cans, which I'm hoping to launch into travel, because it has never made any sense to me why people are allowed to get bladdered and get on a plane. Why would you put 200 people in the sky who are not sober? I don't understand that on so many levels. And so it's this kind of aimed at that kind of market. So there'll be more about that probably in the next couple of weeks, I hope.
Well, that was actually the next thing I was going to ask you was, what is next? What is next on the to-do list? I love the idea of having a myth on a train, that's for sure.
Yeah, so the first couple I'm making, the recipes are a bit secret at the moment, but the first couple I'm making are with the white myth. But the next things apart from that are, so I own an energy drink company as well, which is a completely clean label, but claimable positive outcome. So like Red Bull, but not bad for you and doesn't taste awful. And I've kind of been running them both alongside each other while still keeping my clinic open for the last 18 months. And I'm just in a space now where I'm deciding how I want to carry that forward and where I want to give my focus. So I'm stepping away from my clinic and I'm handing my energy drinks to someone else to care for. And I'm doing the RTDs with Myth. And I'm probably going to go out for funding within the next couple of months and grow Myth as a brand. I've got a couple of ideas for other larger bottles that I'm going to do, and then some more RTDs and maybe a couple of lifestyle drinks as well.
So exciting. It's interesting that you said lifestyle, because that's what it feels like. It feels like an aspirational, it feels like a lifestyle. And again, I think when people stop drinking, the narrative can very much be, as we've already discussed, you know, I have no life now, I don't drink and all of that. But the way that you've created it, and within the branding and the story and just yourself, it, you look on it and think, oh, I want to be like that. And that's a really, really special thing.
2 weeks ago, I was on a boat in Jersey hosting a sober yacht party with the amazing Sober Joe. On Sunday, I'm going to be at Cowdrey Park for the polo, serving there. A couple of months ago, I was in Dubai at the embassy, serving there. You know, these are not boring things. I'm not sitting in the same pub on the same seat with the same drink and the same sorry, you know, in order to have the same regrets the next morning. So I was told something actually when I very first came into sobriety. I was told that you have to create a life that you want to live that's better than the life you had drinking. Otherwise, why would you keep doing it? So I guess I say yes a lot to a lot of things. I tend to say yes and then think, how am I going to do that then? But I say yes first. And I suffer quite a lot from kind of fear, you know, that kind of fear of the unknown. And more as I've got older, that kind of, what if I feel exposed? What if that goes wrong? What if I lose this? What if all of those spaces? What if no one likes me? What if no one likes my drink? What if no one comes to my party? You know, all of that space. And I kind of have to allow that thought and then just do it anyway. and surround myself with really good people, people I can trust, people who I know will be honest with me, but will be kind. I'm very kind as a person, and it's something I really value, kind of old-fashioned manners and kindness. And I look for that in the people who I'm surrounded by. I think it was on my LinkedIn post the other day, I wrote this small story about my best friend, Gemma. She's a strong woman, and she went back into competition a couple of weeks ago in Norway, back into strong woman competition for the first time in 11 years. So this is her comeback. And it was actually her comeback and her leave. It was sort of her retirement thing. And on the first day, when she was like pulling trucks and all those things that I have no idea why she does, I struggle with a jam jar. They're allowed to wear anything they want, anything at all. The second day they had to wear the sponsors' t-shirts. But on that first day, and Gem has her own gym and her own coaching and her own body clinic and all these things, she chose to wear my t-shirt. She chose to advertise my energy drink in her one and only moment that she could have advertised her own things. And I just think that is incredible. She won, by the way, just if anyone's interested. She just went, she smashed it.
Oh my goodness.
And so those things, I think that's where the value really is. And I didn't have those kind of friends and connections when I was drinking. I didn't. I've got young girls now. I've got a really good connection with them. I remarried in sobriety, and everybody who knows my husband would agree he's extremely awesome. Often looks like he's white knuckling it and just in for the ride. But he's awesome, and he doesn't drink. So when he asked me to marry him 15 years ago, I said no because he used to drink. So he just never had another drink. And he's got a real issue when people are like, "Oh my God, that's amazing! You gave up drink for her." And he's like, "Are you saying my wife isn't worth more than a bottle of wine?" Interesting. I think she is.
Wow.
Yeah, so all of those. And I know when I was drinking, you know, people did try to love me, but it was just not possible.
Yeah, that's it. I mean, my dad likes to think he coined this phrase, "If you can't love yourself, how the hell can anyone else love you?" But I have a funny feeling it was RuPaul, and we tell him that every time.
Definitely your dad. No, I'm with your dad on that.
Yeah, it's classic. It's like I always say, it's like RuPaul always says that, Dad, but sure. And it is, it's so true. You know, like there may have been people around us when we were going through those really dark times, and there may have been people reaching out. But when you have that much just desperate self-hatred, it's impossible to see it. And coming into sobriety, the things that I thought I would get my family off my back to leave me alone. So I would be able to just work. I just wanted to work. All I ever wanted to do is work, work, work. And that was kind of all I thought I'd be getting. And what I have got is the ability to sit and be peaceful and just breathe, which sounds so wanky if you're sitting there about to have a drink and think, sorry, no, I'll probably just have a drink, until you've experienced it and you go, oh my gosh, this is life. This is living.
Freedom,
spending that energy. It's just the energy that myself and others, we spend on trying to escape our existence, when we get to put that all down and just be. And the friendships you make and the connections you make and the, you know, just, and like you said, I literally have no time to blow my life up anymore. Mm-hmm. And that's, for somebody who used to work 90-hour weeks in hospitality, I now work maybe like 45 hours a week, so probably about half, which means I've built a life outside of work, something I never had and is incredibly rare for people in hospitality, that's for sure. And I haven't got time to drink. I've got too much stuff going on. I've got too much life to live. That's mental. And I think it's hard when you're in early sobriety to think that that's the thing, that that's your payoff.
Yeah.
But when it happens, it's just, yeah, it's amazing. So funny when you said that your friend Gemma was a strong woman, I thought you meant personality twice.
She's a strong personality as well. She's one of the few people who can say to me, enough, Colette, enough. You're overworking, you're overthinking, you're over whatever. I love my husband very much, but and everyone who knows me knows this, if anyone who is around me were to say, who would catch Colette if she was falling, it would be Gemma. partly because like I'm about a quarter of her size and easy to catch, but partly because she just knows me so well and I respect her. So she would never just say to me, that's enough, don't do that, because she had a problem. It would only ever be because she knew I had. So when she speaks, I just and I really value
and that's it. And you allow her to get that close.
I do.
Another really special thing, isn't it? You know, we allow people to get to know us, warts and all.
Yeah,
because we realize
we like about ourselves, you know, and there are bits I don't like about myself. There absolutely are. And to allow someone into all of that and some of the risk that goes with that, I guess. So for me, being sober, you know, it saved my life. One of the things I think is really sad is my mother was very young when she died, very, very young. She was in her early 30s. And I just think that all the things she never, her name was Catherine, all the things she never got to do. She never got to see, she never got to make better, she never got to know of herself or her capacity. And alcohol steals from us. It steals from person, from society, from relationships. And I really struggle to understand why that is kind of, it's held almost like it's a positive thing. You know, it's not even just allowed, it's glamorized. There's this lie that everyone tells. And that's why my drink's called Myth, actually, because it's about that myth. It's about that lie. Because I saw like an advert for, I think, I don't know what it was, some form of spirit. And it was a guy getting into this fancy car, like a Lambo or something. Well, if you're drunk that, you won't be able to drive that car. That's a lie. You know? Or things like that. It's just it's not true. We've got all these connotations, all these kind of, you see it on the telly at Christmas when people are showing their kind of like Christmas dinners, you know, like when the shops are showing what you can buy for Christmas.
Yeah.
And all these families, you know, breaking open the Prosecco and smiling and laughing and playing Monopoly or whatever they're doing, or charades or something. And we all know that isn't what's going to happen. Yeah. But in my house, because nobody drinks in my house, I won't let alcohol in the house, including if it's in someone. So nobody who comes into my house has either got a drink or has had a drink. So I know what's going to happen here. And I just don't understand how people can live without that, you know, without that.
Yeah.
And again, that's more about my own space.
Yeah, but I think, you know, for me, when I would see those adverts on television, knowing that my life was nothing like that, that was yet more fuel to my internal dialogue of failure, and therefore more fuel to the drink, you know. And it is, I think there has to be some responsibility. And I just wanted to touch on what you'd said there about your lovely mother, Catherine, about just how much she didn't get to experience. And again, within hospitality, we are losing people day in and day out, whether it's because they burn out and they go and work in a different industry because they're not looked after properly, whether it's because they develop such a severe alcohol misuse disorder, you know, that their physical health and their mental health is forever changed. We have people who are taking their own lives, not just because of the job.
My mother was a chef.
Oh, wow. You know, and that's how serious I think that I really hope operators, managers, leaders take it. Yes, we can have a giggle. Yes, it's all fun and stuff. But if you're looking at your team and you've got a team member that's come in every day this week hungover, or you've got a manager that can't shut down without having at least a couple of glasses of wine, if there's somebody within the kitchen, you know, that's coming in a little bit later every day, that's looking a bit more disheveled, be curious, have a conversation. You don't need to sit them down with a bright white light in their eye and say, how many drinks have you had? But just take the time to notice the changes in your team or notice the patterns, because these are the people that we're either losing to other industries, you know, we're losing them for whatever reason, or they're losing their lives. And it's so important to have that.
The question I ask at work when I've got someone coming in who I perceive has a substance problem is I never ask how much you're drinking, or it's not a helpful question, but I always say, is your drinking a problem to you? And then we have a conversation about what a problem looks like. You know, is your drinking causing you a problem somewhere in your life?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like we say, is it costing you more than money? I love that phrase.
Yeah, I remember doing that when I was in treatment. Is this costing you more than money? Oh, only my self-respect and my dignity and pretty much my life.
Yeah, there's just no way of coming back from that one, is there? It's like, yeah. Last question, because I was curious as to your perspective of this, being that you are within the non-alcoholic drink space. Mm. Sobriety, being sober, it's become a bit of a trend. It's like the new vegan. Good yeah. thing, bad thing?
Oh, I'm going to give you a political answer. But bear in mind, I work in psychology as well. Okay, so my personal experience of getting sober was not that I got up one day and put the baby sham down and picked a tennis racket up. That is not what happened. It did not make a pretty Instagram story, and I did not look pretty through it. Okay. Mm-hmm. It was messy. I was sectioned under the Mental Health Act. I nearly went to prison, actually, as well. I lost everything, you know, and the end of my drinking wasn't just because I was drinking one too many pretty cocktails. It was, you know, I was throwing up over myself. I was wetting the bed. I crashed my car. Someone said to me once, you know, when a wounded rabbit cries, a fox comes running, and it's not to help. And I met a lot of foxes. So it was a mess. It was a mess, and I was a mess. So some of what I see now is not coherent to my own story. And a lot of people I work with would also say that. I would also say that it's not really coherent. I do think it's quite a trend. I think it's a positive trend. So I'll counter that with the fact that I think, you know, anyone who's sober is, you know, an absolute positive, because we're beginning to create a new normal. That's the thing. We're beginning to validate a new normal. So that's absolutely positive. I'm hoping that sober serves are going to become elevated beyond alcohol, the way that a lot of plant meals are now elevated beyond meat. And I would hope that was the case. I just think there needs to be a bit of a line drawn when we're talking about treatment, when we're talking about therapy and treatment and recovery and how that looks. And when people are vulnerable and really ill, we need to make sure that those people are directed into boundaried qualified services. That's kind of yeah. what I think. And if you don't know whether someone fits into the category of needing that, then they probably do. So there's someone like me who nearly died, and someone who actually decided that they're going to give up just for a couple of days. So there is a difference. I just think we need to make sure that we're all aware of that, and that's an open conversation. I also think there's a big difference between low and low. That's a bit of a bugbear of mine. So no alcohol is not the same as low alcohol. And people like me, for example, who need to have zero alk, that needs to be very clear. It is a different category. You know, you wouldn't give someone with a peanut allergy half a peanut, would you? And say, well, it's low peanut. So that's, it's okay. Low anaphylactic response. It'll be fine. And all like my daughter.
You shouldn't laugh, but that's brilliant. Yeah, no, you're right.
My, I don't believe I have one more recovery in me, which means one more drink for me. Now, I don't need someone else to validate my belief of that. It is my belief, and that's how I keep myself safe and alive. So I personally believe that the no category needs to be the no category, and the low category needs to be the low category.
Yeah, that makes total sense. And I think, yeah, you're completely right. I think that no two sobrieties are the same. I think people need to realize that it's okay. I think sometimes even I can get into my own head when I see people on Instagram, social media, all of that stuff, presenting this sober life. And, you know, I can get in my own head of like, oh my God, I don't do CrossFit and then have a non-alcoholic gin and tonic. Like, you know, I'm sitting here with my sausage dog eating crisps and like, you know what I mean? And I think sometimes, I think what I'm trying to say is that any type of sobriety is good sobriety. And the problem with the trend part of it is when it starts to make you feel like you're not doing it the right way. Yeah. You know, it's like, are you a vegan or are you a clean vegan or a dirty vegan? You know, it's like for sobriety, I think that people need to know any type of sobriety is incredible, incredible.
It is. And I think that's true about a lot of things now, though. I know that the whole menopause thing, I know we talk about menopause, but the whole menopause thing, you know, am I doing menopause right? Oh my God, I haven't taken up rollerblading. Someone else has. They've taken up base jumping. All I've done is not killed the, you know, my husband. So it's things like that. We've got this thing at the minute where everyone seems to feel that we have to create more aspirational, more ego focused, like bigger, brighter, high def. Are you doing all these things? No, because I don't want to. I didn't want to before. Yeah. I don't want to now. But when someone's very vulnerable and very raw and very exposed, I just think it's worth just being aware of, you know?
Definitely. I mean, I tried tampons and I wasn't suddenly an ice skater. So you're that not, was false you're advertising.
You were using them wrong. That's what it was.
Clearly.
I'm buying incontinence at the minute and I still haven't taken up salsa dancing.
I was going to say, I can't wait to get incontinent because apparently I've become brilliant at salsa.
Well, they lied. Okay, that's what happened. They just lied. Or I hear a lot, you know, because I'm 50 now, and I hear a lot. Oh, you don't look it. You don't look your age. You still do lots of things. You still do. And it's like, well, is there a way I'm supposed to look? Is there a thing I'm supposed to be doing? Am I doing this right? You know, should I be doing something else? And I think everyone just needs to maybe just think, look, I'm doing what I'm doing and my day's going okay. I'm not causing myself a problem tomorrow. And so what if I don't speed knit, salsa dance, or take up rollerblading? It's okay. Yeah. Well, I got up sober, I went to bed sober.
I think that also, that just really nicely speaks into what I am doing with We Recover Loudly, is saying that you don't have to be that bartender that gets drunk every day. You don't have to be that angry chef that screams at his team. You don't have to be that distant manager that's too busy with his face in a spreadsheet to double check that your team are enjoying the shift, that things are running okay. You don't have to be these characters that have become caricature-like in our industry to be successful and valid in our industry. Just be yourself, just be authentic, just be you. And trust me that when you do that without drink and drugs in you, it's a lot easier to do, a hell of a lot easier, you know? Look, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time today and your honesty. And just, I think that it is important to always bring it back to the fact that alcohol is something that is destroying the lives of people and their families. And, you know, it is a really, really dangerous substance. And it is a really scary disease to have, alcohol misuse disorder. But there is another side. And there is a beautiful life out there for people. And anyone listening to this episode who is feeling like they're struggling, there will always be in the show notes some places that they can connect with and people they can talk to. I'll obviously put your details as well in the show notes, Colette, for when people can buy your incredible drinks for when they're ready, or all of that. And yeah, just thank you so much. And I can't wait for them to come in can form. If you need somebody to star in the advert, being on a train, being like a cool, hip, young chick on a train, just drinking one, let me know.
You've got a touch of the Debbie Harry about you, actually. That's exactly how I see it being. That shows how old I am, I think.
The fact that not only have you called me Debbie Harry, but inside I've just gone, oh, God, that's amazing, shows you how old I am.
I always wanted to be Wendy James, to be honest with you. Yeah, I've got that touch of punk about me, you know. That kind of,
oh, you've lost me there.
It's hidden somewhere in my grey Volvo nowadays, but it is still there somewhere.
Oh my God.
I bumped into an old one from the old days, and I was just pulling up, and I drive this big grey kind of XC90 now. And he just went, oh, that's disappointing. And I thought, it is a bit, isn't it? Where's the motorbike? Where's the noise? Where's that?
Yeah, that's it. We get sober, we get a Volvo.
It happens.
We eat 5 a day.
Yeah, we eat 5 a day. I sleep all the hours. I do all the gym. I know. Imagine if that was a cool thing to be doing. And I was like,
no. And do you know what? I wouldn't swap it for anything in the world now.
Nor would I.
You couldn't pay me to go back to those days. Wow. I'm one grateful sober person just for today.
Just for today.
Take care. Colette, thank you so, so much for your time. And yeah, I'm sure we will connect again soon.
Sure we will. Take care.
Thank you for tuning in to We Recover Loudly. Please stay tuned for future episodes, subscribe to this podcast, and share it with your friends. Make sure to follow us on Instagram and LinkedIn for more updates on @WeRecoverLoudly. If you're struggling with addiction and are looking for support, please refer to the resources listed in the show notes, or alternatively, check out the website, www.WeRecoverLoudly.com. If you'd like to be a guest on the show, fill in a contact sheet on the website and we will be in touch. We'd love to hear from you and have you share your experiences. This podcast has been produced in association with the Burnt Chef Project and hosted by me, Shell, recovering loudly so that others do not die quietly.